Welcome to the Online Bodyguard Podcast with host Philip Rendell, CEO and founder of Diffuse, a global threat and intelligence consultancy that blends psychology and intelligence to mitigate threats and risks to prominent people and brands.
Hello and welcome back to the Online Bodyguard. Now, today's a real pleasure for me because I'm going to be chatting with one of my good friends, and he's somebody that's very generously over the years that we've known each other helped me, and I know that he's helped lots of other people. So I'm delighted to introduce you to Paul Blanchard. For those of you who don't know him, he's one of the founders of the personal PR industry, having been in the reputation game for nearly 20 years. If you see him, you'd never know that. He looks far, far too young. Based in the UK, he's a serial entrepreneur and investor, starting his first business when he was just 17, and he's never looked back. With his award-winning media and reputational consigliere, Right Angles, he worked exclusively with global CEOs, thought leaders, entrepreneurs, politicians, and global investors, delivering discreet and high-intensity strategic support. With a full-time team of over a dozen experts, Paul has offices in London, New York, and Los Angeles. His podcast agency operates on a first-to-market joint venture model, unique in the industry, and has many big-name clients with whom he creates premium, impactful content. A podcaster himself, he's also a best-selling author, media commentator, and speaker. Now, I bought his book, Fast PR, ages ago. And I have to say, I have, if you ever see me with it, you'll see it's got 101 tabs in it where I've highlighted and tabbed everything else. And Diffuse are very fortunate in that we've got a great PR mechanism in place, and we get lots of good publicity, and we get lots of opportunities. And some of that, or certainly a lot of that, has come from this book. So I'd highly recommend it, Fast PR. Now, also, his wife, Heather, she's an author. She's a novelist. And they live with their two dogs, Billy and Betty, on a farm in Buckinghamshire in the UK. Now, as many men in middle age do, he's become a bit of a health geek more recently. And in fact, he says, this is his words, not mine, in the possible futile effort to fight the flab and remain attractive. Now, those are words I never thought I'd say about you. But anyway.
I don't think I am attractive, but
you said remain attractive. You stipulated your bio said remained attractive, not be attractive.
I used to look good in the old pictures. Yeah. Now I just look all right.
Yeah. Well, I've never seen the new ones, so I don't know. But
stay away from them.
But Paul is vegan, teetotal. He fasts for 18 hours daily, and he avoids all sugar. He's also a keen runner, although at the moment he's not a keen runner because he's injured and
I'm laid up.
Enough said about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, bust my knee on my electric scooter. What an idiot.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think we need to add anything to that.
That makes me sound really dull. I should probably cut that last bit from the bio because it makes me sound like some kind of weird monk. Do you remember the Da Vinci Code? Do you remember that weird monk in it?
Yeah.
It makes me sound like that, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's really interesting. This is a really interesting point, actually. It's one of my first questions to you is that, you know, when we're talking about personal PR, so we're not talking about you're going to represent a company, you're representing an individual. And one of the things that struck with me of this bio, and one of the things that I'm also aware of when I look at your website and I look at the bios of your team, is that you include that sort of personal information, that sort of, you know, kind of behind the profile information to get to know you a bit, I guess.
People buy from people.
Is that, you know, good practice?
Yes, people buy from people. And no one wants to know your inside leg measurement or what hobbies you had when you were 12. But on the other hand, they want to get a sense of who you are. When you buy a commodity, it's very objective and very measurable, the failure points. You can say, I want 300 widgets in blue delivered by Wednesday. And if it's the wrong color or they're not delivered in time or it's the wrong type of widget, there's something very obvious about that, very provable. And so you don't have to trust people as much when you're buying widgets or anything that's objective, because it's very obvious when things go wrong. When you're buying services, you're effectively buying trust. You're trusting that person, because in any relationship, in consultative relationship, things can go wrong, miscommunications and so on. So what you're looking at is, can I trust this person? And I think the more that someone knows about you as a person, that you can, you know, be trustworthy rather than appear trustworthy, I think that that's the best sales technique, really, because it's not even about whether you're paying someone up front. It's not just about the loss of money. It could be the loss of reputation or getting something wrong or just even just wasting time. If I hire a builder and he's not very good, I've got to knock down the wall he built to before another building can come. So we've wasted everyone's time. So it's ultimately about that person. And interestingly, people look for buying signals, micro signals in the buying process when it's services. So what we think is important actually isn't. So if you go to see a brain surgeon, you don't know anything about brain surgery. You're trusting him that he's doing that. But on the other hand, if you go to his office and his shoes aren't tied and his hair's a mess and his office is a shambles, you think, well, look, I don't know anything about brain surgery, but the things I can measure, this guy doesn't stack up. And that's incredibly important when people are buying services. You've got to be respectful of the cards that you're dealt and choose the way to play them, because actually it's not about whether you're any good, Phil, at your job. Unless you've come highly recommended by a trusted third party, you've got to earn that trust. And you saying you're good is the same as all the other people who say they're good but aren't good. So far, you've done nothing to differentiate yourself. It's the same way that, you know, my wife had a couple of boyfriends before me, and they all said they'd be faithful and, you know, the best husband ever, potential husband ever. Like, but they all turn out to be horrible people. Like, I'm the latest in a long line of putative, you know, partners. But I'm saying the same things as they do at that point. Oh, yeah, you can trust me, love. I won't break your heart. Do you see what I mean? It's the same thing when you're buying services, is that how can you differentiate yourself? It's not by words, it's by deeds. And that's the thing. You've got to show people that you're trustworthy. And a lot of that is just by being authentic. I mean, Phil, I would have trusted you anyway because you're a great guy, but you and I were recommended to each other. So like, we didn't have to prove each other. I think we already trusted each other. And of course, you have the advantage of an absolutely incredible previous career of service, keeping us safe and keeping our parliamentarians safe. So like, I think, you know, you have a strong trust foundation to build on. And I think that's one of the greatest things for you personally to leverage, is because you're not just some Johnny come lately to this. You know, you were a copper for all those years, keeping us safe. And if you weren't very good at your job, you wouldn't have stayed so long. And you're now taking those skills into the private sector so that, you know, you can, you know, basically you're protecting people. And that also fascinates me, because there's two things, isn't there, about what you do and a bit about what I do as well, which is there's the distress purchase side, in the same way that if I blocked my toilet, I'd call a plumber and he'd charge me 100 quid to unblock it. But there's also an element with us of, we'll help you make sure you don't block your toilet anymore. This is a terrible analogy, but do you know what I mean? So we're the, both the toilet unblockers, but we're also the people who says, and here's some fiber tablets to make sure it doesn't happen again. Because what we also, again, this is too graphic, but what ultimately people are buying from us is peace of mind. They come to us with a problem, so we've got to solve that, but we've also got to stop it happening again.
So going back to the personal information, is there a risk though of, if you're expressing, you know, if you're sharing your values and, you know, you're saying I'm a vegan and I'm this and I'm that, is there a risk also around people saying, oh, bloody vegans, I'm not dealing with him?
Well, my only worry about all of that is it makes me sound dull. Not that I'm not worth hiring, which is, so I might delete that out of sheer vanity, not out of any commercial imperative. No is the short answer, because ultimately, people want results. Like, they are buying the end result. And, you know, I don't care if someone wears flared trousers, as long as they can do what they say they're going to do. Like, you know, I think a few quirks here and there make you interesting as a person, helps establish that rapport. And I think it also makes you memorable, because I'm sure you've been to networking events or conferences where you come back and you're in your hotel room that night and you open your briefcase or your trouser pocket and there's like 20 business cards in there. And like, I've got no attention anymore because of the internet, but like, part of me is thinking, who the hell was that guy again? And I once saw someone about 5 years ago when I was at a conference, and I handed him my card and he wrote down a few things I said on my card. And he said, because tomorrow I won't remember, it'll all merge into one. I thought, that's a clever idea. So now all of our business cards have our portraits on, and also they have a little bit about what we do, because actually that's the thing that makes you memorable, that hook. But ultimately selling trust. So yeah, you've got to give away just enough, I think, just to show that you're a real person. And I think the more, the less you give away, the less likely someone is going to buy your services. I don't like these websites where it's just stock photography and there's no sense of a name or a person behind it. I think the first thing I do when I click on a company website is I go to the about page. I want to know who's behind it, who's the leadership, what have they done, etc. Because I'm doing that to sort of make sure that these are the kind of people that I'd like to do business with.
So, okay, let's move on. So personal PR, what is it?
Well, it's, I suppose you could say what we do builds on and runs alongside traditional PR. So the old way of doing PR is that a company would have a think about how many widgets they want to sell and what territory and everything. And they do all that thinking internally, and then they'd reduce it to writing in the form of a brief. And then they'd send that brief out to 50 agencies and say, right, which one of you wants to work with us? And normally there'd be what I call a beauty parade, where they'd shortlist five and all five companies will be nervously waiting in the company's reception, waiting to go into the boardroom to present. And then they'd just hire the cheapest one, or they'd hire the one whose brother-in-law's secretly on the team and undeclared. You know what I mean? It's always a stitch-up. It's why we never tender, because it's always a stitch-up. And I think sometimes my refusal to tender or do a proposal is the very thing that's actually differentiated us from that. And then the problem with that is that you then reduce the sort of action points and tasks. It becomes a transactional relationship. And I think the clever thing to do PR properly is in the inception of the idea, you know. I want a blank sheet of paper. I want a client to say to us two lines, like, make me famous, get me a Nobel Prize. You know, why's that guy got done this and we haven't? And I like that, where ultimately we're given the goal and we decide what the means are rather than them. Because it is slightly odd, actually. I wouldn't call this a fictional plumber and say, I want you to unblock my toilet, but I want you to use this type of plunger. He'd say, can you just let me get on with my job, fella, and let me do it the way? Do you want your toilet unblocked or not? I know better than this. I've been doing this 30 years. And I think it's a little bit odd in marketing and PR that clients, they obviously know their own business, but they don't. That's not the same as knowing how to take it to market. They can fatten the cow, but they don't know what the buyers of that cow in the farm marketplace want and need. And I think that ability to communicate it. So I've often thought that's slightly odd. So I refuse to sort of be reduced to sort of that. So what we do builds on and runs alongside it. And I think organizations and companies under-leverage the power of their people. So we have these superhero entrepreneurs like Richard Branson and Elon Musk that have got it right. But there doesn't seem to be any sort of medium-type successes where people think, oh, well, I'm not Richard Branson, so that's not for us. But actually, Phil, you know, you've got your business diffuse. Let's be honest, though. People are going to buy from you. Like, it's not just about checking you out and seeing everything that you've done. It's also, if you aren't on the front foot as the ambassador, then actually, I think that's a missed opportunity. So what we do is we amplify that and build on and run alongside traditional PR, because people buy from people. And it was also based on the fact that no one wants to read brochures anymore and sales pitches and stuff. So thought leadership is the actual best way to sell. The best way to sell is to not sell. I wouldn't even read a brochure on my own company, because it's going to have stock photography of people looking at a chart around a boardroom table. It's going to have a few bubble quotes of some generic person saying, these people are great. Well, we wouldn't quote them if they weren't saying that. So like, no one looks at that. So how do you get on the radar of meaningfully? It's by doing thought leadership, by giving away what you've learned, because that's actually the way to do it. And I always say, all of anyone who might be interested in dealing with you is always listening to the radio station WIFM. And that stands for What's in it for me? Like, they're interested in you, but only to the point that they satisfy themselves that you're the person to unblock the toilet. Now it's about, well, can you do it? When can you come? Everything else. So it's a two-stage process. And people sort of, as I say, under-leverage that important part of hiring someone. You know, we've just changed our gardener. The previous guy did an all right job. Now we've got this amazing gardener. He does the same thing the other guy did. He just does it with more passion. He's more reliable. He's friendlier. And he's actually a bit more expensive, but I don't mind that. I'm willingly paying him because he's a pleasure to deal with. It's that meta narrative, that meta relationship, where it's not just about the gardening. It's also about my relationship with the gardener.
So in the internet age, though, where, I don't know about you, but I mean, you know, whenever I'm dealing with someone, I'm straight onto Google. I'm straight onto LinkedIn. I'm straight into all these things to try and check out, well, who is this person? And you know, there is so much information out there now about people. In fact, there's more information out there about people than they even realize is out there about them.
That's your game.
Exactly. But why do they need you? Why with all that masses of media out there, how do you then control the narrative, if you like, about what is being said about this individual?
Well, to some extent, you can't. And also, I tell clients that they're adrift on the sea of news because there's no such thing as an objective story value. I mean, you know, launching an amazing product or saving the life of a celebrity or whatever it might be could be incredibly interesting and could be a front page of a newspaper. But if the Prime Minister was shot or the Queen died on that day, you're not going to get in. Like so, and it also works the other way. Sometimes I'll think a story could be a page lead on page 7 of the Evening Standard. And then because nothing more interesting has happened, it gets put on the front page. You know, that's the thing. One of my clients, my old clients, Metro Bank, we got them on the front page once. And he said, I can't understand why that got on the front page and other more interesting things that we've done haven't. And I was like, well, that's because other more interesting things were ahead of you in the queue that day. Whereas if the Evening Standard had something that was more interesting that day, they'd be daft not to put it on the front page. Of course they're going to do that. So it's just that they didn't have it. So there's a little bit of, there's no such thing as an objective story value. So I don't necessarily think it's about controlling the narrative. I think there's two issues. One is inbound attention and the other one is attracting attention. So inbound is usually scandal-led. A company will have an accusation leveled against them and it could be false, it could be true, who knows? And there's an element of human nature. So we get hired for crisis PR. And the first thing is, even though they're very clever people, their first thing is, well, can we ignore this and it'll go away? No, Jeff, you can't. It's going to be happening. And they'll say, well, let's just say nothing. And I'm like, well, The Guardian are going to do two pages on this. It's a big story. They can either spend all of that time speculating on the 7 things that you might do, all of which are damaging, or we can just tell them the thing we've actually decided we are going to do. And then they can at least discuss the ups and downs of that, but discuss it their will. And, you know, we can make sure their facts are right and corrected, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, part of it is telling the client, this isn't going to go away. In fact, let's seize this as and try to make this the best of the opportunity or the least worst damage, as it were. The harder job, though, is actually engendering interest and in a product. So like, you know, I might say to, if a journalist has got a new range of widgets out and they're really proud of it, I'll go to a journalist and they're not paid for to represent the company. They don't have a bit of Stockholm syndrome like I do. Because, you know, Leslie, who runs that widget company, I've been for lunch with him. What a lovely bloke. He deserves all his coverage. I start to believe these widgets are good, right? Then you get that big reality check, that record scratch, where you talk to a journalist and say, these widgets are amazing. And he's like, are they? Who cares? Why should my readers care about this new range of widgets? What's new about them? And it's that's the bit, is trying to engender interest is incredibly difficult because people don't see it from the journalist's point of view. It's why, and I say this in my book, it's why people dress as chickens when they're doing the London Marathon. Because look at it from your point of view. You've trained for 3 months, you're going to raise money for charity, your family and friends are behind you, it's incredibly exciting. You pulled your muscle a month ago and you've just recovered and you were worried about whether the marathon was going to happen and you're going to do it and you're so proud and your mother's there to cheer you on. What an amazing thing. Why wouldn't a journalist be interested in you? Why? Because there's another 26,000 people doing it. And why are you any different? And that's ultimately the key about dressing as a chicken. Because if you dress as a chicken, that's the only thing that interests a journalist. Because they're going to put a microphone in front of you and say, why are you dressed as a chicken? And you're going to go, well, I'm glad you asked that. It's because of this, this, and this. And that's the bit about like making yourself more interesting and optimizing the story. The other thing that's interesting as well is tension makes stories interesting. And that could be tension between people, but it could also be tension in terms of uncertainty of outcome. So the difference between marketing and PR is marketing would say, we've made 2 million quid this year, stick a press release out there. It wouldn't get any coverage at all. Who cares? A company you've never heard of has made 2 million quid. Who cares? PR is convincing them to say this company was facing bankruptcy last year. 4,000 jobs were in the at risk, and now because of this big order, not only they're safe, but we're going to hire more people. Now the chief executive thinks, well, why do we have to put that bad stuff in? Because like it's good news, but they're not PR people. It's only in the relief of the tension that makes it newsworthy. So I can't say, well, there was a generic but unspecified threat to the business last year, which is now gone. Do you know what I mean? I'm not Yoda. I have to say, no, you know, it was, and that's PR because if you persuade people to be fully authentic and tell the whole story, that's the bit that interests them. But so half of it is working on the client as well as working on the, you know, working in the media as well. Because actually, if you get a story strong enough, you don't need to control it. It sells itself. You know, think about if your local library lent its millionth book Now, they'd have to do a press release. There'd be Mrs. Miggins there, 92, with a nice picture, been handed the book by the Lord Mayor, and it'd all be nice. And, you know, the local newspaper might do something about that if you persuaded them and they had a journalist available. They probably wouldn't send a photographer. You'd have to send your own picture, and it might be on page 8, right? But you'd have to persuade them. What happens if the library burnt down to the ground and there was 4 fire engines out there and one person died? Do we have to press release that and persuade them to run it? Absolutely not. It's that whole push-pull thing. So by working on making the story interesting in and of itself, you don't have to then persuade the journalist to do that. If you have to do that, you're already onto a loser. And there's loads of techniques that you can do that are truthful to optimize the story's interestingness, to where a journalist will want to cover it. And that's the bit that I find absolutely fascinating.
So you've used the word story a number of times. And, you know, the more I'm kind of immersed into the business world and have been for the last 3 years, this concept of storytelling comes up time and time and time again. Is that part of PR, the ability to tell that story? And you know, we as human beings are, you know, our ancestry is steeped in storytelling. And once upon a time, we sat around the fire. We you know, we learnt from stories and what have you. So is that part of the gift of PR, to be able to communicate that story?
I think it's everything. So, like, once that microphone's been put in front of you, why are you dressed as a chicken? Why are you dressed as a chicken? Like, you have to work that out. So it's called, the old marketing funnel is called AIDA, attention, interest, desire, action. A is the attention. You know, you've dressed as a chicken. You've engendered the interest. But at that point, you have to have that story so that you're ready. And you do see it where sometimes on the telly, embarrassing, where, you know, they've got on the news, but then they probably didn't think they'd get on the news, even though they set out to, and they're shocked by that. And then they actually don't have that story to tell. Or they think they've got 7 minutes on BBC News at 6, whereas, you know, Laura Koonsberg doesn't get 7 minutes. They're not going to give you 7 minutes, John. They're going to give you 30 seconds. So you better have something to say up front and sort of hone that, you know, the so-called elevator pitch. So it's preparedness. And knowing what that story is. But yes, absolutely. I mean, as I say, people buy from people. You know, you do have to have that story to tell, because otherwise, what are you selling? Metrics, widgets, you know? It's only the story that gives you that something to sell. Your life story, or the story of client journeys, successes, learned, where you're taking things next. Ultimately, if you're at a conference in the audience and you're watching people on stage, what are they telling? They're telling stories.
And stories are the way, you know, a key way of communicating. I mean, in terms of, rather than just regurgitating facts, if you can embed that into the story so that there is, in some instances, learning from that story, that is obviously a better way to communicate.
I have a Ford Mustang. I don't know what the torque range is for my Mustang. I don't care. What I care about is it looks $1 million. And in 1960s Americana, all those adverts had really attractive women in bikinis there. So even though I'm very happily married, I got a car like that because that might, you know, it increases my prowess with other men and makes me more attractive. Now, of course, whether that's true or not, I don't care about what torque level it is. I buy all the car magazines and they have these fact boxes, right, on the side. Who cares? I don't. Maybe other people do. I want to know what the color is, what the dashboard looks like, and how it makes me feel. Yeah. Like, that's what you're selling. You're selling the outcome. And I think sometimes you can get distracted by the measurements of it, because no one cares about the features of a product or a service, or very few people. They care about the benefits. Why is someone buying that car? Is it just to get to A to B? Well, you can buy, you know, a secondhand car for $3,000 that'll get you to the shops reliably. If you're going to spend more than that, then why are you spending more than that? Is it status? Is it reliability? Is it speed? That's what marketers do. The cliche is, you know, no one goes into a DIY store to buy a drill bit. They're going into a DIY store because they want to put pictures up in their living room and they need a drill to do it.
So in your book, you say PR is not about you. It's about them, the reader, the listener, the viewer. Is that what you mean in terms of, you know, no one wants to just hear about you. It's about, well, okay, this is who I am, this is what we do, but this is how we benefit you. So that's about the listener, the viewer, et cetera.
It's about me. And it's about you just enough to satisfy that person that you're trustworthy. After that, if you go on more about yourself, you're then boring that person and missing an opportunity. So you've got dwell time, you've got attention deficit, but you've got that attention time to try and catch someone's attention. The analogy I used to use, because I'm old, is the Yellow Pages. And it, when you need a plumber, you open the Yellow Pages up, and all of the plumber's adverts used to really annoy me because they all used to say the same thing. We unblock drains, we unblock toilets, we do this. We know what a plumber does. Why are you wasting my time doing that, right? They should have been using that advert to differentiate themselves from the other plumbers on the page. We come faster, we're cheaper, we wear uniforms, whatever. We speak 20 languages, whatever the USPs are, that's what it is. But regurgitating a list of things that the customer already knows you can do is just a total waste of time. But it's exactly the same. So that finiteness of attention, I used to be able to communicate that in the sort of 90s when I used to do this, started doing this as a Yellow Pages. Now it's dwell time, it's attention. You'll give a banner advert half of 1 second. You might listen to 5 seconds of an advert on a podcast before you forward wind it. You've got to get that message across quite quickly to distill that unique selling point and differentiate yourself from the listener. What are they buying? It's either the older adage is fear of loss outweighs the desire for gain. So you've got to show you're trustworthy, but you've also then got to show them, what are you getting for? You're going to give me some money, Phil. You're going to give me 500 quid. Am I making a problem go away, or am I preventing a problem from happening and therefore you're buying peace of mind? So I either unblock your toilet and that helps you, or you've had some blocked toilets recently and I've got a product that'll stop that from happening and will save you money in the long run because you've spent £600 on plumbers unblocking toilets last year. This £100 product I'm going to sell you means you don't have to call the plumber ever again. So like, is it saving money? It's that kind of thing. And it's that distilling of, well, what are they buying? What's the outcome? And I think people don't do that because they get distracted by the doing of it. People fall in love with the process of their own business and they therefore dwell on selling that process. Who cares? Like, if I can get you in Forbes, Phil, do you care how I do it? As long as I don't bring you into disrepute and I don't do anything unethical, who cares if I DM the editor or email him or send it? You know, leave that to me. Ultimately, if I get you in Forbes, happy days.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating. My wife is, you know, you've met Amanda. And she has,
she's amazing.
Yeah, she has this thing about... you know, selling the benefits. That's what you've got to do. You know, exactly as you're saying, no one cares about what you do or how you do it. It's about how does this impact their life? How does this better their life? And that's all people are really interested in. So when you're looking at personal PR and you're looking at individuals, is that in a way kind of branding, building up that individual's brand?
It's the problem with that phrase, personal branding, is these words become meaningless, don't they? Because I'm not a personal branding person, because to me that conjures up imagery of buying the right pairs of trousers and whether to wear makeup on telly and things like that. And I don't know. I'm legally prohibited from giving anyone fashion advice for legal reasons. My wife has an injunction.
Luckily, this is auditory only.
Exactly.
For that exact reason, in fact.
So, and I also think, you know, short of advising you to have a shave or whatever, like, it's not my place to say that. As long as you look, you know, you look respectable and you dress, you've got clothes on, then that, if that's authentically, I'm fine with that. So what branding to me is that capturing attention in the right way, establishing trust, showing trust, but then distilling what the three sort of key things are that you want to get across to someone. You know, this, I hate the phrase elevator pitch, but ultimately it is about that. So I think branding for me is distilling who you are and what your offering is, rather than not being clear on that and then just trying to hone a press release around it or saying what branding is. Because I think if your product is strong enough, it'll sell itself. I've always thought that. So like with yourself, you know, are you trustworthy? Because fear of loss outweighs the desire for gain. But also B, okay, I like this guy. What can he do for me? And like, you've got 60 seconds to tell me. Because, and not to sell me, because I'm already sold, I like you, right? So now, what is it? What are you trying to alleviate? Is it pain? Future pain? Are you going to give me peace of mind? Or are you going to solve a problem? Or both?
But does that not morph into who I am as a brand? Or, you know, in terms of, if we look at Elon Musk, yeah, he has a personal brand. He may not necessarily have consciously developed it, but when you think about Elon Musk, you have a certain perspective. And the same way when you think about Richard Branson, is that not their personal brand?
I've met Richard Branson many times. I don't think he's inauthentic, but he's very shy, and he's not the same when the cameras aren't on him. It's odd. So he switches on. One of my clients used to work with Prince, and Prince never said a word to anyone. Like, literally, he was mute. And then the second the TV lights went on and we're live, Prince, thank you for joining us, he would then be Prince. And I think that's, I don't know, that doesn't necessarily work for me, because ultimately it's not about selling you. It's just about selling you, just enough to establish trustworthiness, because then it's about what is it that they want. And I've often found that my best sales meetings in the first one is just listening. That, again, cliche alert, but you know, you've got two ears and one mouth and you're using that order. Half of my proposals are just repeating back to them what they told me. And that's not some trick. That's actually important that I've actually, you know, effing understood. I've got to show genuine understanding. So how do I do that unless I A, genuinely listen, and B, actually codify what my understanding is? So, and again, I always think that someone says, oh, so your proposals are just repeating back to them what that client has told you. And I'm like, yeah, because that's what they need. Like, surely we all, if we're going to have a target and a series of milestones, we need to be clear and aligned on what they are. So if I'm not going to say that, what am I going to say? I'm going to come up with a completely different set of goals, you know?
Yeah. But you deal with, you know, top end people. You're dealing with the most successful people on this planet very often. And that may mean the wealthiest. It may mean some of the most famous. It may mean some of the most influential. Do they have similar concerns? Are there kind of trends about why they want you, and what are they concerned about? What are they worried about?
We have two types of clients. We have type one would be ambitious chief executive looking to leverage their personal profile to help grow the business. So it is a genuine win-win for them and the business. So like Anthony Scaramucci is a very dear friend and a long-term client. You know, he's like a Virgin Richard Branson thing where, you know, he's all over the media, but he's talking about Skybridge. He's talking about Salt. He's talking about all the things that he's doing. And he's authentic. He's passionate about crypto. He's even better on CNBC when he's defending crypto when it's going down, because it's real. You know, and I love that about him. And he's a lovely guy as well. He's exactly the same when the cameras are off, when the cameras are on. And I love that about him. So that's a type one client. The other type that we have, type two, is what we would call a legacy client. They've made tons of money. They're an ultra high net worth individual. They have a family office. They're not in business. They've often handed the reins over to their protege. It might be their son or daughter or whoever, but they're not making widgets anymore. They still might own the widget business, but they're not running it. They might be in the 60s. And they might have some investments, but they're not actively in business. And they're looking at legacy. So there's usually three parts to that type of person. One is looking backwards. They want some kind of recognition for what they've done. They often would like... although we can't be seen to be lobbying, but we do, because there's a dignity issue there. But behind the scenes, they'd quite like to win a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Widget Manufacturers Association, particularly because Jeff in the golf club, who also makes widgets, why, he got it 3 years ago. Why haven't I? So, you know, so there's an element of recognition there. The middle bit is the present. They want to be kept busy. And I don't mean that in a patronizing or shallow way, but it might be a memoir. It could be a blog or a podcast or something, but they've got something to offer. And also they'll think, well, I used to be about, kill or be killed. I wanted to dominate the widget industry. But now that I've moved on, I think the widget industry itself has got a problem or an opportunity that it's ignoring. And I want to help the widget industry, not just my own business, but, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. They become altruistic. They become all of that. And so there's an element of that where they then want to get involved in sort of taking the industry forward rather than dog eat dog increasing market share within the industry. So there's a bit of that. So that's the beginning, the middle. And then the end bit is something about legacy. They'll say, you know, I'd like to be a philanthropist. Do I set up a trust fund? Do I invest in an existing charity? How can I do something that's genuinely going to outlast me? And that's an incredible privilege. I think they each have advantages and disadvantages, really. The advantage of type one is they've got stuff to talk about, because if they're making widgets, then they've got a new range of widgets next year to talk about. So there's a pipeline of stuff that they can say. Whereas the type two have just legacy. They've got one career that they want to talk about, and they might want to talk about current affairs. They might not, but like there's no pipeline of announcements. So, you know, you've got to keep the focus on them and keep them doing stuff. On the other hand, type one clients usually fire us after sort of 2 or 3 years because either energy's fizzled out, they might get taken over, they might move. There's like a finite amount of time to that kind of thing. And also they might take ages to sign because, you know, big companies often have committees that have to sign things off. So like we work for a very big Japanese gaming company and they took 4 years to hire us. And don't get me wrong, they're amazing. But like literally we started talking to them 4 years ago. And because of the Japanese culture with this ringy, I don't know, you know, it can take a while. But they're a great client. But on the other hand, with the type two, with the legacy ones, how can I put this delicately? Father time is not their friend. They're already old. They don't want to delay. You know, they might say, well, I've only got 10 years left, so I'm not going to ask around and wait 2 years to decide. So they tend to decide quite quickly. And then they're also slightly more in a hurry to get the right type of publicity earlier. So a type one client might say, let's do a TED talk in year two. Whereas one of our type two clients would say, right, we need to do a TED talk in the next year. Or if we need to get a book out, let's do it. So and I enjoy both of them. I think it's nice to have a spread, but they're absolutely fascinating. They're all incredibly interesting people. You know, I've got a team of 20 on staff and I always say to all my team, we call it the triple multiplier of interestingness. So they're interesting people that are in an interesting period in their life, a transition period, and they want to do something interesting with it. And that is interesting.
So if we go move on then to the other piece, because that's the sort of strategic PR piece, if you like. If you then move on to the kind of crisis communication bit, you know, Churchill was famously quoted as saying, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on.
And bear in mind, can you imagine if he was alive now during the Twitter age?
Can you imagine it? I mean, that's incredible that was said all those years ago. Now in the internet age, how do you manage global clients with all the different time zones as well when these sort of scandals are hitting in an age where, as Churchill said, before you've even woken up, it's front page news in certain parts of the world? How do you manage that?
It's difficult, actually. I mean, I'd say about 20% of our work is crisis management. Often, human nature being what it is, something will happen because. And it's a shock that it happens, but it's not really a surprise because it was inevitable. Like I worked for a bank for many years and the chairman and the vice chairman and the CEO, they didn't speak to each other. It was a dysfunctional relationship. They had an unspoken agreement that if they walked past each other in the corridor, they would acknowledge each other if there was colleagues there because it would look weird if they didn't. But if there was no one else in the corridor, they'd just blank each other. Like it was that dysfunctional. And inevitably, you know, things went wrong. So there's an element of having to persuade the company to do the right thing about it. And often it's the very fact that they failed to address it is the very reason the crisis is happening. The other thing is sometimes there's like, say if a director's got caught in some wrongdoing, caught in a bordello or something, there'll be three people that can decide that person's fate. One will be at his mother's funeral. The other one will be up a mountain somewhere on retreat in Tibet. And then the other one will be on a train with no signal. And I'm like, if the Guardian need to get back to me, I need to get back to them within an hour with what we're doing about this. I don't know what the company is doing about this. Are we firing this guy? Are we suspending him? Are we standing by him? Are we going to buy him counseling? I don't know. Like I need, even if you give me one baby step in one direction, someone has to tell me what we're doing about this. And honestly, you'd be surprised just how difficult it is when just to get people, the right three people in a room. And, you know, so with some of our very big clients, we have a laminated card with a Zoom call thing on it that says, if there's a crisis, this is how you get in, this is your PIN number. Like, and I'll text them and say, right, let's get on the blower right now. I only need a minute of your time. What are we doing? And sometimes I'm there while they decide. It's like, you know, those meetings can get quite heated, particularly if that guy who's caught in this fictional guy caught in a bordello is mates with one of the three people who says, God, we should give Jeff a chance. His marriage is, you know, he's been saying his marriage is in trouble for a few years now. I'm like, well, do I tell the Guardian that then, Jeff? Do you know what I mean? It's like, what are we doing about it? The next thing is how do we communicate that? So like, and again, no one, you can make things a lot worse if you don't own the situation. So like United Airlines had this huge problem where they punched that poor guy in the face and dragged him off the plane. And what made it worse, though, was the United Airlines did a tweet that says, we regret having to reaccommodate this passenger. What? It's like written by a robot. And like that made it worse. And I think there was no humanity to it. And I know why that was. I actually saw it on the CNN when that happened. And I winced. I thought, this is textbook failure. Because CNN were doing it on a split screen because they had this tweet. And then they had the other screen that said this bug. But you could see he's had blood. He wasn't reaccommodated. And they lost $1 billion off their stock market because they mishandled that the next day. And I know why they did. It's because the lawyer wrote that tweet. That lawyer on day one would have said, well, if we apologize, or we might have to pay this guy another $1 million. So we've got to be very careful about the language we use. So that lawyer, thinking he was clever to save the company $1 million, wrote a tweet in such a way that lost the company $1 billion the next day. And that's the importance now of reputation. Is we don't have a chief reputation officer at board level. When the shit hits the fan, it's usually the lawyers that deal with this. And yeah, don't get me wrong, the lawyers are an incredibly important piece in the jigsaw, but they're not everything. They don't know how to handle the media. So I think sometimes I do come into conflict with companies in crisis because I say, why is he deciding all of this? You know, because actually that person genuinely believes that they should make all the decisions. Well, why? So that's important that we get that strategy right. And then also, is the leader of the business believable? Are they sorry? Now, and there's what I call the arsehole test. If they're an arsehole, our job is to do a press release and hide them from the media because they're going to make it worse. If they're genuinely apologetic, the first thing I would do is get them on the media. So like when that lady lost her legs on the Alton Towers roller coaster, the chief executive of Alton Towers went straight on Sky News that night, and Kay Burley, she basically knocked 7 bells out of him. But actually, if you watch it on YouTube, no one can doubt the fact that he's genuinely upset. Like there was tears in his eyes. You could just tell from his language, everything he used. And like, he's like, it's not in my interest that people feel unsafe or whatever. Of course I've got, because he didn't operate the ride, but he is responsible for it. And it felt authentic and it felt real. And most people watching this, watching that, felt reassured that it wouldn't happen again because he took it seriously. And I call that the pizza shop problem, the pizza manager, where let's say you're running a pizza shop, a pizza restaurant, and you're the manager and you sat upstairs and you're doing the books and you're managing the thing. And someone calls up from downstairs and says, there's a family that's very upset here at the service that they've received. And you're walking down the stairs to come and talk to them, right? Did you cook the pizza? No. Did you take the order for the pizza? No. Right? So as you approach, the family were annoyed. You don't know what happened. The chef might have got it wrong. The waiter might have got it wrong. Or it might be that the family are just one of these horrible people, but you don't know. All you can do is the toolkit of methodologies. Number one, lead on empathy. I'm desperately sorry that this has happened to you and mean it. I don't know what went wrong, but I'm going to get to the bottom of it to make sure what I'm going to get. Tell me it from your point of view. Let them feel heard. And then that's what people want. They want to be treated with respect and treated and genuinely believe that you're taking it seriously and that you'll do something about it. That's all you can do. What else can you do? You didn't cook the pizza. It's exactly the same then with the United Airlines thing. The reason why I winced is because what they should have said, and I don't work for United Airlines, the chief executive should have gone on the TV and said, look, I wasn't there, but I can tell you my first thought was I felt desperately sorry for that poor man. I felt desperately sorry for the officer that had to arrest him because it was nothing to do with him. And I feel desperately sorry for my colleagues and customers on that plane that had to witness that. This is a horrible thing for everyone to see. And my first thought is we have to get to the bottom of why this happened so it can never happen again. And I'm embarrassed. That's all. Like if they'd have done that, they wouldn't have lost £1 billion. If he'd have meant it, that's actually how he should have handled it because he didn't cook the pizza. You know, he didn't punch that man, but he is responsible for it. So one, is he sorry? Yes. Two, do I believe that he's going to get to the bottom of it? Because three, that can't happen again. If I believe those three things, problem goes away. And that's where people like us have to work behind the scenes. Because I remember when Group 4 had loads of prisoners escaping from their prisons and they got some terrible PR from it, right? The guy who does Group 4's PR, or certainly did 10 years ago, is a genius. Is the best PR that you could possibly imagine. Now, anyone who doesn't understand PR will say, what? All those headlines saying with the prisoners escaping, that you can't be a genius. They don't understand how the media works, right? First of all, does the PR man lock those prisoners up with the key and walk away? I've seen the Green Mile and jangle the key. No, he's sat in an office, right? Is his job to mitigate the potential worse outcome? Yes. So no one would even think this, of course, unless you're an insider like me, a PR person, would say, what a clever guy. That could have been infinitely worse. But he mitigated that the damage. What a genius. He can't cover it up they run a prison for the public and the answer to the government, and a prisoner escaped, right? But he didn't do it. But like, in terms of managing the fallout of that, he made sure that the governor was on there and everyone else, and saying, look, you know, we take this unbelievably seriously, but and we're going to make sure, here's the things that we think we've got wrong, and this is how it's not going to happen again. And again, we're back to PR versus marketing. Listing the things that they got wrong, a marketer would say, why the hell have you done that? Or a lawyer would say, why the hell have you done that? Well, we've done that because that's the only thing that's going to persuade people we take this seriously. How can we stop this happening again unless we can show that we're aware of what went wrong?
So, I mean, I always feel when I listen to, as an example, sort of celebrities reading out a press statement after something's happened, and it's blindingly obvious they haven't written it. The vocabulary that's being used is quite clearly not their vocabulary. And, you know, I've got no doubt it's written by a lawyer or someone, but it comes across then as inauthentic because it doesn't feel like it's come from them.
Well, it hasn't, has it? It reads like it's a lawyer writing it because a lawyer has written it, like you say, and it just looks ridiculous. It can go the other way, though. Like, you know, when Alec Baldwin shot that poor lady, no one thinks he did that deliberately. Someone's made a mistake. Who's made it? And it turns out that he is innocent. Well, I think he was too open because he appeared with his wife, Ilaria. And you know, I know Ilaria a little bit. She's a lovely lady. But like, they were almost bickering in front of the cameras. So like, you've got to strike that balance because like, you expect someone to take it seriously. But if there's alleged criminal wrongdoing, you have to be respectful of that process. And again, what Alec did really well in that is he always led with, well, I'm desperately sorry for that poor lady's family and friends. She's dead and no one wants, you know, I knew her. She was my friend. I'm gutted. Did I believe him when he said that? Yes. But on the other hand, he might have, you know, this is where it gets technical, isn't it? Because although he probably didn't set out to shoot her, he is a producer on the film that has vicarious liability and he needs to be careful. It's always the difficulty, because I say this in my book, if you make canoes and little Tim is drowned in one, they're going to come for you. The family are going to say it was the canoe, right? What do you do? You can't say, no, it wasn't. You know, because that seems insensitive. But neither can you say, yeah, it probably was our canoe. That probably is why little Timmy drowned, right? So you've got to end up just being respectful and say, look, we've been in business 60 years. No one has ever died in our canoes. When we heard the news of Timmy's death, we were all absolutely shocked and upset for the family and for everyone involved. Now, there's a health and safety investigation involved and the police, so we obviously can't prejudice that. But, you know, if there are any lessons for us to be learned from this, of course we're going to do that. But, you know, we at the moment are just desperately sorry for poor Timmy and his family. And what else can you say? And that is actually fair enough. If you mean it and you do it sensitively, then that's actually the right thing to do, because you can't prejudice a health and safety or a police investigation. They might say that it is your canoe that killed him. Or they might say it's got absolutely nothing to do with your canoe. It was the instructor that told him, that said, yes, you're taking on water, Timmy, but don't worry about it. Like, but what you can't do is this thing where you say, well, we're not even going to discuss it. You know, like this, we regret having to reaccommodate this passenger. What you can't do is sound like a robot. But neither, again, this is where you have to be very careful in getting that response right.
So that authenticity is key then.
It is.
Yeah. So talking of authenticity, you know, we're in an age now where fake news appears to be the flavour of the month. And it sometimes seems that news articles are driven by the headlines rather than the detail in the detail and the evidence of the actual article. But when you're dealing with somebody who has had fake news, or there's fake stuff out there, you know, how easy is that to get taken down? How easy is it to remove that sort of material?
More difficult than you'd think. We have an online reputation repair service, and most people come to us when they've already written to Google, this so-called right to be forgotten. Google don't like that. You know, they come from America. There's the First Amendment free speech sort of principle, and the European Union have come at it from another angle. So Google have like 100 people in an office whose job it is to bat away those requests. And normally they can do that quite easily. If you're upset what the Luton Gazette said about you, then take it up with the editor of the Luton Gazette. You know, don't be going to Google. And there's some truth in that. And also they have to balance, you know, protection. If your next door neighbour is a paedophile, you ought to be able to find that out if he genuinely is, because that, you know, you ought to just take care of your kids and your personal security just in case. I mean, so there is an element of that. But like, you know, there was that very famous case of the Butcher of Harley Street, a poor lady, a surgeon that an operation went wrong. And of course, it's perfectly normal that surgeons, like, they will have complexities and things go wrong, 1 in 2,000 operations. You know, the British Medical Association, no doctor or surgeon is perfect. So it's, the question is the failure rate of this surgeon above the norm? Because, you know, you are going to get things wrong. And this woman was called the Butcher of Harley Street at the General Medical Council. The Daily Mail splashed on that. And the next day she was cleared. But of course, if you Google her, it comes up that she's the Butcher of Harley Street, because they were factually right in quoting a barrister saying that about her in court. So, like, they haven't broken the law in that. But, like, let's say that, you know, your lady wife needs an operation and you just quickly check out the surgeon and you, it comes up that she's the Butcher of Harley Street. You're not going to have that. You wouldn't think, well, you know, given a meta-analysis of all of the overall aggregate of her operations across a 22-year career, it's likely that she's actually overperforming in terms of safety. And obviously she won that. And, you know, it was unfortunate that poor lady did sue her and blah, blah, blah. You wouldn't think any of that, would you? You'd click page two and find another surgeon because, you know, do you want the Butcher of Harley Street operating on your wife? No. And that's the thing, isn't it? This whole duality of facts versus emotions, because actually and it ruined her career. So rightly, you know, that was taken down because it was just ruinous, and it also wasn't right. Yeah. So you can get some things removed. It's very difficult. There are lots of organizations like Trustpilot and Glassdoor and things like this that sort of thrive on anonymous negative things being posted about people. And they're very difficult to remove. But you can get it done if you throw lawyers at it. You can also create new content to push it down. So there's, you can normally, I would say European media is more amenable to reason and having these taken down. Because if a newspaper has printed something bad, then normally there will be a proper process in place to complain about it, a managing editor and an editorial code where at least they're amenable to reason. The problem is the plethora of just absolute nutters with blogs and things like that where, you know, and they can create lots of fake Twitter accounts and everything. And then that can be, that's the crazy bit, because it's like the Wild West, you know, that you can't appeal to their reason. And sometimes it's even not even worth engaging with them because they want to feel they've drawn blood. You know, if you get a vexatious former employee or wife or whatever it is that might be bored because they've lost their job and they just sat there blogging about you all the time, how, you know, even engaging with someone like that, they'll feel that they've got you. So it's just not worth it. But the question is, how do you deal with it? So on some blogs, you go to the hosting company. If it's WordPress, they actually do have a legal team that will take things down. But if it's like Medium, again, they're First Amendment nutters. They will, unless it's like naked pictures of you, they will host a website saying you're a paedophile and not take it down. And they say, well, you've got the right of reply. You could add a comment at the bottom saying that you're not a paedophile. Oh, that's all right. Oh, cheers, fellas. Appreciate that. There's a very strong element of, if you deny something, does that give it legitimacy? So like, if I knocked on your front door and said, oh, you know, hi, Phil, I'm your new neighbor, Paul. Just so you know, my wife and I, we're not doggers. We're not part of the dogging community. You'd think, these guys doggers? Like, why have they led on that? So like, sometimes, like, you have, when you know, if you've got nutters accusing you of things, it's actually, you need to think twice about, is it even worth legitimizing it with a denial. When David Cameron was accused of having sex with that pig, which is a ridiculous thing to suggest, but let's be honest, for 3 weeks, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom was, the hot topic was whether he'd had sex with a dead pig. Now, he said, I'm not going to dignify that with a denial. And actually, that was quite clever, actually, because it was ridiculous. And I think if I accuse you, Phil, of having sex with a gorilla in London Zoo, you wouldn't write a blog post saying why it's nonsense. So there is an element of picking and choosing your battles here, because sometimes the denial of it can actually increase the visibility of a problem. It's called the Streisand effect. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it's named after the actor and singer Barbara Streisand. She, all of California's coastline is public property, and everyone has the right to take a picture on it. And a gentleman did a website about it where it basically was the entire coastline. One of these pictures had Barbara Streisand's back garden in it because she had a beautiful beachfront property in Malibu. And it is beautiful because I've seen it. And it had like, but the point is that it had like 40 views. And when they took action against him to try and have that removed, that docket, that court action became a matter of public record and led to loads of publicity about her attempt to silence this picture. Now, if you click on it, because there's a view count, it has 1.4 million views. So again, you know, sometimes the act of engaging with critics is the very thing that amplifies it. And the problem with people like me, of course, is I can charge you 100 grand to make that problem go away. But if my advice is say nothing, Phil, you might think, well, is that worth 100 grand? Like, because you want like a something you can feel that you've paid me for, like a statement or something where you feel I've had some graft. But actually, if you're buying outcomes, then if saying nothing is actually going to solve the problem, then that is worth 100 grand.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because we come at it from a different angle in terms of profiling the individual. And sometimes we've gone back and said, this person is narcissistic. We're not going to feed their narcissism by engaging with them. So exactly. We're just effectively going to starve them of oxygen and they will go away. But just one more question, because I think it's a very interesting one around this. I know we've taken up quite a bit of your time today, but
I think I've waffled on. You're going to have to edit a lot of this.
Don't worry. We can edit that, don't worry.
My worry about editing out the crap bits, though, is it might only be an 8-minute podcast. But anyway,
We're going for 5 minutes and it's going to be brilliant 5 minutes. You're probably your best ever. But podcasting. I know you're big on podcasting. You know,
waste of time.
You've got a business does it. You've got your own really successful podcast. What is it about podcasts that seem to have gripped people's imagination and seem to be so popular? And I, you know, we've got a podcast because it's just a brilliant way for me to speak to people I really want to speak to, much as anything. I actually get that out there. But what is the real, you know, in terms of the benefit, why are podcasts so successful?
The three best things I've ever done in my life are marry my wife, get Billy and Betty, my two dogs, because they're amazing. And I couldn't be without them. I couldn't be without Heather, all three of them. And starting my podcast. It's been amazing. It's been utterly life transforming and been the best thing I've ever done in my career. Why? One, I genuinely enjoy it. I get to speak to the very best people in the world for an hour because I've got a big audience and I learn. And like, I don't think you can get that from anywhere else. You couldn't learn that from a textbook. I think it also builds my Rolodex. I've established some amazing relationships with the very biggest editors. Like, I genuinely do know the editors of like the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Fortune, Fast Company, Harvard Business Review, like everything. I know them and I know how they do their job. And that makes me better at my job because they're telling me how they want to deal with PR companies. I also think, even though I don't sort of trade on those connections, I think it's just an indirect benefit of what I call evidence of Rolodex. You know, people perceive that they want a well-connected PR person because they think that that's the means to an end. And actually, it's not necessarily about connectedness. It's about the ability to optimize a story. So people think I can get them in the Wall Street Journal because I know the editor of the Wall Street Journal. The reality is, and I tell this to clients, is if I need to get a client in that, I wouldn't pitch it to Matt Murray. I'd say, right, it's a transport story. Who's the transport editor? I'd look it up in our database. We'd get the story right. And I'd say, hiya, Leslie. Your transport editor of the Wall Street Journal is our client. Do you want to cover it? And she'd say, yes. So clients are buying what they think of as outcome and process. But actually, as long as they get the outcome, the fact that the actual process doesn't differentiate or is different from how they perceive, because I don't endorse that, but neither do I sort of challenge it. So it's great for business as well indirectly. So I think the intention, though, is actually, do I learn? Do I have an interesting conversation with some amazing people? And the answer is yes. But for the podcast, if I email the editor of Harvard Business Review and said, hi, you know, I'm a generic PR person, one of 20,000 that's trying to spam you every day. Can I have a coffee with you or a chat? Rightly, that would just be binned. And, you know, the podcast is a very good way of opening that door and starting those relationships. I do enjoy it. And I think you can sense that because I really do like it. But as you've said as well, it's also a great way of building a rapport and getting potential clients on and all of that. We say that to our clients, you know, you can have a podcast and invite prospects on it. Because if I have another podcast, New Thinking Podcast, and, you know, I have some lovely people on there that aren't media. It started as a way of saying, well, I can't even justify getting this interesting person on my podcast because he's nothing to do with media. So I have my my other podcast, as it were. But also, I get prospects on there, and I'm very, very open about that. You know, I could say, hi, generic prospect. Do you want to meet me? I'm one of 20,000 people, PR people, that say they're great and will deliver the earth and haven't. But I'm different from those guys. Can I have a coffee with you? And the answer is rightly no. If I say I present the New Thinking podcast and, you know, you have a big audience and would you like to come and talk? And they say yes. It's a device, but it's a... So in one way, it's cynical, but in another way, it's actually quite meaningful because then we have a great when we do that. It's also, between me and you, reveals them to want the limelight. Like if you're going to hire a PR person, if you're shy and want to stay out of the media, you're not going to hire me. So if you say no, you've done me a favor because I won't pursue you anymore. You either don't want, you've got something to hide or you're shy or whatever. But either way, that doesn't translate into dollars into my bank account.
So your company, that the podcast company you have, what's the trick then to making that podcast successful and really building that audience?
The first thing is it's got to be real and it's got to be interesting. You can put all the marketing tricks and social media optimization and all of these kind of things, and that'll get someone to listen to your podcast once. If you crap, no one's going to come back. So like Steve Wright in the Afternoon, listened to him for 30 years, total ledge. They've now got some guy from Radio 1 who everyone else has heard of and I haven't because I don't listen to Radio 1, I'm old. And I'm going to give him a week. Like, if he's not very, don't get me wrong, I'm already tuned to Radio 2 in the afternoon, so if he's good, then brilliant. But if he's not, then I'll go to Magic or something. So first of all, it's about dwell time, about retention, stickiness, as it's called in the game, is to keep people coming back. You've got to be good. So that's the first thing. But in terms of establishing that audience, it is making sure that your audio branding is right, your visual branding, that you've got key guests that have big audiences that can grow your audience. I've always found that one of the things that that can grow my audience is having high profile guests on that are interesting because they actually act as unpaid marketers and ambassadors. They tweet, oh, I was on Paul's podcast, click here to listen. They've got a million. When Anthony Scaramucci's got a million followers. He did like three tweets saying he was on Blanchard's podcast and we got like 65,000 new listens. Now of that, about 10%, 6,500 stayed with us for future episodes. That's bloody good. You can buy that kind of publicity. Not only was he a really interesting guy, but he was an unpaid marketer that's brought on 6,500 more regular listeners to my podcast. And those other 90% could be because it wasn't the right fit, we were boring, whatever, but I see it as a bonus. So yeah, I think it's important that you get you work out what the audience wants. It's the whole Henry Ford thing, though, isn't it? If you ask what they want, customers, they say faster horse. So, like, you have to be innovative, but also make sure that it's the right type of product that's going to... Because if you're the same as all the other podcasts that's going to come along, then you're not going to get any audience. But on the other hand, if you're so left field, people aren't going to listen. So it's that awkward middle point. But no battle plan ever survives contact with the enemy, as they say. So, like, Media Masters has changed massively. I've done it for five and a bit years now. And... You know, how I go about doing Media Masters is the best it's ever been because I've got 5 years experience. Like even the first year, if I'd have asked a question that have said, well, you know, that was a bit of an obvious question or people shouldn't have known that. I'd get Kev, my editor, to cut that question out because I was frightened of not being seen to be an expert in the media. Whereas now if I ask a question and it was a bit of a stupid question and I'll leave it in because I've got the confidence to do that. But also, what happens if my listeners don't know that? I mean, it's that. Have you ever been at a conference or in a meeting where someone says, "What does NQT stand for, Bob?" And everyone secretly thinks, "I'm glad he asked that because I don't work." But everyone's thinking it, yeah. So it's that kind of level of doing
but,
that.
But that's going back to the point about, you know, much as the podcast, the doing the podcast in many ways benefits me because I get to speak to people like you and other people. But also I have to be conscious it's not for me, it's for the listeners. And so I might know all about the subject, but I'm trying to introduce subjects to people that don't know about it. So therefore, the obvious question might be the best question.
It's difficult. And then you've got the podcasting problem, which is what do your listeners want out of this?
Yeah.
You've got to listen to them because don't get me wrong, it's your podcast, you're presenting it, you're going to benefit from it anyway. So the key is to make sure that you're delivering for the listeners because you don't want what I call a graveyard podcast. You know, we have those, you know, with clients that have started it on their own and then come to us where they start them in a fit of enthusiasm and then just give up because there's a challenge or whatever. And then I don't even know why, but they then leave it on their website. I'm thinking, why would you do that? Why would you have six podcasts that are 2 years old one week after the other, because it's obvious that you set it up in a fit of enthusiasm and have just left it. Can't you delete it and never speak of it ever again? You know, like I do that with all my failures. Like I just deny that they happened. I learn from them. I delete them. And then that's it. I pretend to myself that did not happen.
Listen, Paul, I could obviously go on all day talking to you because you're a friend, but B, because I'm fascinated by what you do and the level of expertise and experience you have. But I'm conscious of time. So thank you so much for your time and for your wisdom. And talking of exciting and interesting guests, our next guest next month is going to be Suki Bakker, who is the chief executive of the Susie Lampley Trust, who again is a personal friend of mine. And Susie and I work together in Parliament, and she's going to be, I know it's going to be a fantastic podcast of all about stalking and the Susie Lampley Trust and all the work they do. But for today, Paul Blanchard, thank you so much. We will circulate, as always, the details of Paul's various podcasts and what have you. And if you want to know more, I suggest you go out and buy his book, Fast PR. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Phil. It was a genuine pleasure. You're a legend.
Thank you for listening to the Online Bodyguard podcast with host Philip Grindel, CEO and founder of Diffuse. Please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platforms.